Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And everybody was exchanging recipes and saying, I'll never see you again. Can you give me the recipe for your that chocolate cake? And people also said, I'll give you my recipe because I want you to remember me.
Food writer Claudia Roden collected recipes from Jewish refugees in the 1950s and 60s. That became her first book, A Book of Middle Eastern Food. Since then, she's written 11 food books. She's in the studio with us today. Chef Daniel Orr is cooking for the holidays already. It's duck and parsnip soup on the menu. From Harvest Public Media, the problem of transporting all of the grain from this year's harvest. And mistletoe is a nuisance to orchardists in England. We'll hear how they turn it into some extra holiday spending money. Food news that caught our eye this week. Luann Johnson is here.
Supporters of the Mandatory Labeling of GMOs initiative, Measure 92, in Oregon, conceded defeat last week. A court refused a lawsuit challenging the rejection of thousands of ballot signatures. Measure 92 failed by an extraordinarily thin margin, 812 votes. It received an automatic recount beginning December 2nd. 4,600 ballots were thrown out due to discrepancies between the signature line and signature card on file. Under a new law, the Secretary of State's office released those names publicly. Despite the loss, many supporters of Measure 92 are staying positive. In the face of opposition spending topping $20 million, the slim defeat shows promise. Measure 92 would have required raw and processed foods sold in the state of Oregon to be labeled if they contained genetically modified organisms. McDonald's customers in Japan are now unable to order medium or large French fries. Only small fries with those Big Macs in Japan. The reason for the rationing is a potato shortage, thanks in part to labor unrest at U.S. ports on the West Coast. Japan is the top destination for exported potatoes from American farmers. And ugly veggies have been getting a lot of press lately, and we're loving it. Earlier this year, French supermarket Intermarché started marketing less-than-perfect vegetables to customers. They purchased blemished produce from farmers that would have been thrown away and sold them at a 30% discount. Did customers buy it? They sure did. Intermarché saw overall store traffic increase by 24%. And in fact, competing grocery stores are now trying out similar ugly veggie campaigns. In the UK, the supermarket chain Waitrose is selling weather-blemished apples. And on this side of the Atlantic, Canadian Safeways are starting to feature displays of misfit produce. There are many other examples of ugly veggies finding a home in grocery stores. Find the link to this NPR article on our website, eartheats.org. And Annie, one more thing about Intermarché. They sell shakes and soups made from the quirky produce to convince customers that even though they look a little weird, they taste just fine.
And yeah, actually, Luann will be doing that exact thing in today's show. Some gnarly parsnips will become a soup. All right, Luann Johnson, always a pleasure.
You got it, anytime.
Harvest season is over, and for the Midwest's biggest crops, it was a big one. With winter setting in, the race is on for farmers to ship out their harvest so it's not left out to spoil. But as Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports, that's created a traffic jam on the rails and the highways.
It's a clear, blustery day on the Missouri River in Glasgow, Missouri. Mike Watchering and his team from MFA Agri-Services are loading soybeans onto a barge. A large chute fires the beans onto the boat.
Our system will allow us somewhere around 5,500 bushel an hour to be put on the barge. So it's going rather well today for as cold as it is.
Usually farmers store their harvest in silos and grain bins. But this year, farmers brought in so much, there's just no room, especially in Missouri, Indiana, Illinois, and South Dakota. Normally, when farmers want to sell their crops, they truck their corn and soybeans to their local grain elevator, where it catches a train to its destination, a big animal feed company or a ship ready to export. But this year, the few rail cars up for grabs got snapped up. Watchering says he's still waiting for his first set of 25 rail cars.
We're supposed to ship three sets of 25 this fall, and we haven't even got the first set shipped because cars were not available to us.
So, for the first time in more than a decade, MFA has put river barges back in service to get the grain to its buyer. The freight trains that typically lug grain away have been slammed with orders and are having trouble keeping up. That's due in part to a shortage of cars and competition for space on the railways from oil and gas companies in the midst of an energy boom. John Miller of BNSF Railway says the burgeoning oil and coal sectors in the upper Midwest are compounding the congestion problem, even though they use different types of rail cars.
Not real happy about it, but there hasn't been any one sector that has been disproportionately affected. It's been across all the networks.
To help ease the block, BNSF says it's investing $1 billion to expand the railway network, add 900 new rail cars, and hire more than 5,000 people.
If there's not enough storage, rail service problems persist, grain could be stored on the ground and run the risk of spoiling.
That's Bruce Blanton, Director of Transportation for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He says there were less than 6,000 rail cars loaded with oil back in 2007. In 2013, that number shot up to 400,000. Pair that with a bumper crop harvest, and that creates a lot of cargo with little space to move it. With the backlog of railway shipments, deliveries have been late and even missed. That's why some growers are changing their sales strategy.
They're looking for more marketing opportunities domestically since they are having trouble on the rails, which can be shipped shorter distances perhaps by truck or barge.
But selling locally means farmers might not get the best prices. And even those truck and barge services are pressured by high demand and limited space. Barge rates are climbing, and some states are extending the river navigation season and increasing weight limits for trucks. Back on the barge, the cargo hold is about 75% full. It takes 8 hours to fill up completely. MFA's Mike Watchering says putting the barges back in service cost nearly $50,000, so he hopes the barges stick around to help in the spring and for next harvest.
The barges really came in at a great time. Our numbers are way up on everything that we've handled, and it will be a challenge to get all of the corn hauled off.
He says even though the barges help, the transportation crunch won't be solved overnight. Till then, farmers can only hope enough space opens up for the remainder of their harvest to ship. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media tells stories of food and farming in the Midwest. Read and listen to more at harvestpublicmedia.org. Claudia Roden has been called an historian, a storyteller, a cultural anthropologist, but she prefers simply a food enthusiast. She's been writing about food for 60 years, publishing 11 books. She was born in Egypt, moved to Paris for school. She then settled in London in her early 20s, and that's where she's still based. When she visited the Earth Eats studio this fall, I wanted to learn about her food life growing up. In Egypt, who was doing the cooking in your house?
We had a cook. We were Jews, and we were Jews from Syria and from Turkey on one side. We cooked different kinds of food. We were also very Europeanized. We spoke French at home and Italian because we had Italian nannies. All of us had Italian nannies, but the cooks were people from the villages, were always men, and they came from Upper Egypt. They had no idea how people cooked in Cairo, where I lived. So the women had to teach the cooks. And the cooks got to be better than them in the end, because they also stayed forever. That was the pattern. And they also, all the cooks were at the top cooking for themselves. They were given money to cook what they liked. And it was different from what they cooked in our homes.
So let's go back then to 1968, your first book, a book of Middle Eastern food. So I want to just talk about the process of collecting recipes for that book. What did you do to get the food that you put in that book?
Yes. Well, in 1956, when I was an art student in London, all of a sudden, because of the Suez War between Egypt and France, England, and Israel, the three countries had attacked Egypt. In retaliation, Gamal Abdel Nasser threw out all the Jews because Israel had taken part. And myself in London, suddenly my parents joined us. myself and my two brothers. And for the next 20 years, we kept having floods, really. We were inundated by Jews from Egypt who had become refugees. And at that time, one thing that everybody was asking, apart from, have you heard from so-and-so, have you heard from so-and-so, everybody was exchanging recipes and saying, I'll never see you again. Can you give me the recipe for your, that chocolate cake? And people also said, I'll give you my recipe because I want you to remember me. So there was this frantic or passionate exchange of recipes, which never happened before. In Egypt, everybody was jealous of their recipes. All the women were rivals about how they cooked. And then suddenly now this was something. And to me, it became something really important and relevant. And I just started taking note of everybody's recipe. That's how I started. I was just 20 when it happened, and my mother was 45. They were mostly women my mother's age, and they were saying my mother and my grandmother. So I guess many of the recipes would have been from the 19th century. And I have to say that's what people are cooking today in London.
I'm so struck by this idea of I'm never going to see you again, have this recipe so that you'll never forget me.
Yes.
I'm so struck by that. So they really thought that this was an integral part of how they define themselves, these dishes.
Exactly. It was really, that's when I realized that food was not just a dish for sustenance, not just for pleasure, but it meant so much more. It meant identity. It meant roots.
So then you're so much more than a cookbook writer if you're collecting these recipes that people are so touched by and connect with so deeply. You had to somehow personalize them and put the person into the recipe. Is that true?
I had to do that. And at that time in Britain and in London, in particular, people were not interested in food at all. Food was just not a subject. It was even a taboo subject. And if I asked people what they cooked or I told them what they cooked, I had a look of horror and embarrassment. And when I told them it was about Middle Eastern recipes that I was collecting, they would say, oh, is that eyeballs and testicles?
A logistical question about writing a cookbook. As you're collecting recipes, did you get proportions and measurements from people?
No, they didn't have them. It was by looking and by feel that you learned. It wasn't by reading. And people would tell me the kind of thing, for instance, for a dough. They would say, put as much flour as it takes. And I was saying, how much could it take? How do I know? And they would say things like, well, while you're doing, when you start working the dough with your hand, with one hand, with the other hand, feel the lobe of your ear. And when it feels the same, then that's how much it takes. That's it.
But you have recipes with proportions. So did you try out all these recipes?
I tried every single recipe.
And so you say, okay, a half teaspoon of cumin and 3 cups of flour and...
Yes, and very often I think that they were more right than we are, as you
know. Just doing it by feel.
Yes, because the flour, flours are all vary. But even flours made from wheat that grow in the same field, every year they absorb a different amount of water. So how much it takes is in a way sensible.
Claudia Roden, cookbook author, she calls herself a food writer, cultural anthropologist, historian, storyteller, whatever you want to call her. She's written 11 cookbooks. What a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak.
Claudia Roden is one of the foremost writers on Jewish food in the world today. She was in the Earth Eats studios early this fall. Coming up, the dark side of mistletoe.
It's a parasite. So this plant grows by living off of the nutrients and energy of the plant that it is attached to.
Its favorite plant to live off of?
apple trees. Maria Kennedy studies apple orchards in England. She talks about how farmers deal with mistletoe this time of year. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats, welcome back. I'm Annie Corrigan.
All right, so let's get these ducks going.
Chef Daniel Orr is crashing his friend Gretchen's kitchen today in Columbus, Indiana. Perfect recipe here for the holidays. Check it out.
You can, if you want to, you can cook duck so it's kind of medium rare and pink inside. But we're going to do more of a traditional roast duck where we're going to let it get really nice and crispy and crunchy and have that great crisp skin.
That's the best part.
Yeah. But first, what we want to do is season our ducks. And I've got 2 small ducks from Maple Leaf Farm right here in Indiana. And I'm going to season them with some salt and pepper. Always using fresh ground pepper, so it has all those nice essential oils in it. And we're going to cut up a little bit of citrus to stick inside. And what that does is kind of helps cut the greasiness a little bit. And gives you that nice perfume. So I'll put about 1/2 lemon in each one. And then we're going to add, of course, garlic, which is one of our favorite flavors. Okay, so we're just going to cut this garlic clove kind of east to west. So you really expose all the openings of the garlic. And then we're going to put some rosemary and thyme inside. The richness and the fattiness of the duck will really pick up these flavors of citrus and the pininess of the rosemary. Thyme's another good one. And these herbs are also herbs that kind of last later into the fall and early winter outside. If you cover them up with some leaves from the garden, you can kind of keep them going almost through the new year.
The thing that makes this duck recipe unique is how we're cooking it. Over a fire, in a fireplace. It's time-consuming, so you'll want to put this on pretty early in the day and then watch them, baste them on occasion as well. Daniel suggests setting yourself up with some good cheese, maybe some chestnuts and some wine, maybe some good company to help while away the 3 hours of cooking.
You don't want a whole lot of flame. You don't want to cook over a high flame. And as you can see here, I've got this little pan that we're going to catch the drippings on. And I'm going to put the ducks towards the back because I don't want them just to drip on the fire and have a lot of flare up. So we're just going to start these guys. We'll start them on the breast side down. The liver's going there. This we're going to let go a little bit quicker. I'm going to move these ducks just back a little bit.
Just over here we have the organ meats from the duck cooking up in a pan.
Yeah, kind of spitting out at us. We're going to throw a little bit of my sweet seasoned spice blend. It has some of those kind of Christmassy aromas to it. And these will be great in stuffing, or we can mix them in with a little bit of wild rice, which would be really tasty. You can use the necks for stock. But there's still actually a good amount of meat, and my mother loves to chew on these necks. So we'll probably just throw them right on the grill with the ducks.
photos and step-by-step instructions for this duck preparation at eartheats.org. Maria Kennedy was with us several weeks ago talking about apple orchards and cider making in Herefordshire, England. She's a folklorist who has done field research in the UK. Not only is this a great climate for apples, Herefordshire, it's a great climate for mistletoe. Brits love to decorate their homes with the stuff this time of year, but the flip side of this holiday tradition is if mistletoe is left to its own devices, it can absolutely take over an orchard. Maria tells us more about how orchardists deal with the plant. She describes mistletoe as these fluffy orbs hanging from the branches.
It's kind of like, you know, a big green leafy Christmas ornament just hanging off an apple tree. And they're really distinctive this time of year because all of the leaves have fallen off the trees by now, by Christmas time. And all that's left are these green orbs of mistletoe. And they can be anywhere from, you know, the size of an apple to the size of a beach ball. So you might not notice them throughout the summertime and the fall while the rest of the leaves are on the tree. But once the leaves drop, there they are.
There they are. Orchardists like mistletoe. Mistletoe is a nuisance to them. How do they see this plant?
It's a little of both. It's definitely a nuisance. It's a parasite. So this plant grows by living off of the nutrients and energy of the plant that it is attached to. And one of its favorite varieties of tree to grow on is an apple tree. And so it's sucking out energy from the tree, and it grows over time. So if you get one on a tree, then you're going to probably get more, and it's going to spread through your orchard. I've seen some old trees that have so much mistletoe on them that the tree is just, you know, on the edge of dying.
So, and that's the worst case scenario here. What do orchardists do to manage mistletoe?
You can prune it out. It's not going to get rid of the plant because it does send its roots into the tree. Orchardists are going to be pruning their apple trees in the wintertime anyway, because they need to maintain the tree so that it's giving as much energy as possible to the new fruit the next year. So while they're pruning out dead wood or old wood, they can also prune off the mistletoe. And it'll, you know, you can still keep trees with mistletoe in your orchard, but you don't want it to get out of control.
The orchardists are selling some mistletoe, though, right? So this is another revenue stream for some.
It is. It's kind of like a little I heard someone describe it to me as like their Christmas money. So it's not a big amount of money that they're making from it. It's just a little extra. There is a town in the west of England, a town called Tenbury Wells, and they've had there for over 100 years a mistletoe auction. And this is all stuff that's been pruned off of local orchard trees. I talked to one guy when I was there who'd come all the way from Ireland in a van to load up the whole van with mistletoe and take it back to Ireland to sell in their Christmas tree shop. Wow. And there's it's also a really interesting. There's farmers who are selling. There are also, in Britain, there are gypsies, also called the Roma, also called travelers. They can be a kind of marginal social group. They do different kinds of work. One of the things that they happen to do during this time of year in this part of the country is go and offer to prune out the mistletoe for farmers, and they'll take the mistletoe to the auction to sell. So there was a point a few years ago where they were going to shut them down. They just weren't profitable enough. And there was a real drive to keep them going. And there were people who wanted to save the tradition, so they started a mistletoe festival. And they ended up saving the auction, so the auction still goes on as well. But the mistletoe festival is kind of an interesting cross-section of different groups who have different stakes in the history of mistletoe. You've got your very traditional, sometimes conservative farmers who are pruning it off their trees, and it's a pest. You've got your druids who are, like, really into it for these symbolic reasons.
The gypsies who do the pruning.
It's a real interesting mishmash of different parts of English life. That's all in neat. This little town.
So people in the UK like to decorate their homes with mistletoe during the holidays. That's a big thing.
And definitely in that part of the country, too, where it's just everywhere. Basically, mistletoe likes to grow on trees in a very specific environment. It likes to have some air and some sun, wants to have some space. It likes a moist, kind of not too cold climate. So I used to live a little further north from the area where the mistletoe is really prevalent. And I could just drive literally an hour south from where I lived, and you could see where the mistletoe started growing, just a different microclimate.
Maria Kennedy, thanks for coming in to talk about mistletoe.
Hey, thanks, Annie.
And Maria Kennedy will be back with us again in the new year when it's time to go a-wassailing. Don't miss a single Earth Eats episode. Be sure to sign up for our podcast on iTunes. We were singing the praises of ugly vegetables earlier in the show, you know, the foods that aren't perfect enough to sell in most grocery stores. So you might ask a farmer if she has some bumpy and knotty parsnips you can buy on discount to use in this recipe.
Well, parsnips are one of the great vegetables that you can leave in the ground most of the winter. And until you get a super, super hard freeze, you can just go out and dig them. Things like sweet potatoes, you need to dig those before the first frost. But the parsnips you can just leave in the ground, and they have their own little refrigerator going. So we've got some garlic browning. I would say 3 cloves of garlic. And to that we're going to add 2 white onions, and these are diced in about 1/4-inch dice. We're going to add the parsnips. And I'm going to leave this more of a rustic soup. I'm not going to puree it today. We're going to leave it nice and chunky. I'm going to add about 3 cups of water to this. All right, I'm going to hit this with a little bit of salt and pepper. And we'll just cover it and let it simmer.
That's it? That's it?
We'll come back and finish it with a little heavy cream. It is Christmas, so, you know, we're going to use some heavy cream in this.
The cream is key for this soup. So good. Daniel is also adding a special touch, sweet potato leaves.
We're going to just add these in, and they'll give us a nice kind of contrast of colors and textures. Another wonderful thing to do with this soup would be to finish it with some freshly shucked oysters. A great way to serve them for people that may not like them raw, but would like them just slightly warm through. And what I always say is you just cook them until they start to smile. And that means they're just going to kind of crinkle up around the edges, but you don't want to bring them to a boil. You just want them to smile a little bit in the pot. Here you go. Have a taste.
Don't mind if I do.
It's very hot.
Parsnip soup. Yes, very hot, but so satisfying. The recipe is at eartheats.org. Sending warm holiday wishes to our staff, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Have a wonderful holiday. See you on the flip side. I'm Annie Corrigan.